The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, we will continue with the ninth of the 13 short stories published by J.D. Salinger in the New Yorker magazine. From the January 29th, 1955 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Franny by J.D. Salinger. Though brilliantly sunny, Saturday morning was overcoat weather again, not just topcoat weather, as it had been all week and as everyone had hoped it would stay for the big weekend, the weekend of the Yale game. Of the 20-some young men who were waiting at the station for their dates to arrive on the 10:52, no more than six or seven were out on the cold, open platform. The rest were standing around in hatless, smoky little groups of twos and threes and fours inside the heated waiting room, talking in voices that, almost without exception, sounded collegiately dogmatic, as though each young man, in his strident, conversational turn, was clearing up, once and for all, some highly controversial issue, one that the outside, non-matriculating world had been bungling, provocatively or not, for centuries. Lane Coutel, in a Burberry raincoat that apparently had a wool liner buttoned into it, was one of the six or seven boys out on the open platform. Or rather, he was, and he wasn't one of them. For 10 minutes or more, he had deliberately been standing just out of conversation range of the other boys, his back against the free Christian Science literature rack, his ungloved hands in his coat pockets. He was wearing a maroon cashmere muffler, which had hiked up on his neck, giving him next to no protection against the cold. Abruptly and rather absently, he took his right hand out of his coat pocket and started to adjust the muffler. But before it was adjusted, he changed his mind and used the same hand to reach inside his coat and take out a letter from the inside pocket of his jacket. He began to read it immediately, with his mouth not quite closed. The letter was written, typewritten, on pale blue notepaper. It had a handled, unfresh look, as if it had been taken out of its envelope and read several times before. The letter is dated Tuesday, I think. Dearest Lane, I have no idea if you will be able to decipher this, as the noise in the dorm is absolutely incredible tonight, and I can hardly hear myself think. So if I spell anything wrong, kindly have the kindness to overlook it. Incidentally, I've taken your advice and resorted to the dictionary a lot lately. So if it cramps my style, you're to blame. Anyway, I just got your beautiful letter, and I love you to pieces, distraction, etc., and can hardly wait for the weekend. It's too bad about not being able to get me in the Croft house, but I don't actually care where I stay, as long as it's warm and no bugs and I see you occasionally, i.e. every single minute. I've been going, i.e. crazy lately. I absolutely adore your letter, especially the part about Eliot. I think I'm beginning to look down on all poets except Sappho. I've been reading her like mad, and no vulgar remarks, please. I may even do my term thing on her if I decide to go out for honors and if I can get the moron they assign me as an advisor to let me. Delicate Adonis is dying, Cytherea. What shall we do? Beat your breasts, maidens, and rend your tunics. Isn't that marvelous? She keeps doing that, too. Do you love me? You didn't say once in your horrible letter. I hate you when you're being hopelessly super male and reticent. Not really hate you, but am constitutionally against strong, silent men. Not that you aren't strong, but you know what I mean. It's getting so noisy in here, I can hardly hear myself think. Anyway, I love you and want to get this off special delivery so you can get it in plenty of time, if I can find a stamp in this madhouse. I love you, I love you, I love you. Do you actually know I've only danced with you twice in 11 months? Not counting that time at the Vanguard when you were so tight. I'll probably be hopelessly self-conscious. Incidentally, I'll kill you if there's a receiving line at this thing. Till Saturday, my flower, all my love, Franny. 20 X's. P.S. Daddy got his x-rays back from the hospital and we're all so relieved. It's a growth, but it isn't malignant. I spoke to Mother on the phone last night. Incidentally, she sent her regards to you, so you can relax about that Friday night. I don't even think they heard us come in. P.P.S. I sound so unintelligent and dim-witted when I write to you. Why? I give you my permission to analyze it. Let's just try to have a marvelous time this weekend. I mean, not to try to analyze everything to death for once, if possible. Especially me. I love you. Francis. Lane was about halfway through this particular reading of the letter when he was interrupted, intruded upon, trespassed upon, by a burly set young man named Ray Sorensen, who wanted to know if Lane knew what this Rilke was all about. Lane and Sorensen were both in Modern European Literature 251, open to seniors and graduate students only, and had been assigned the fourth of Rilke's Duino Elegies for Monday. Lane, who knew Sorensen only slightly but had a vague categorical aversion to his face and manner, put away his letter and said that he didn't know, but that he thought he'd understood most of it. "You're lucky," Sorensen said. "You're a fortunate man." His voice carried with a minimum of vitality, as though he had come over to speak to Lane out of boredom or restiveness, not for any sort of human discourse. "Christ, it's cold," he said, and took a pack of cigarettes out of his pocket. Lane noticed a faded but distracting enough lipstick streak on the lapel of Sorensen's camel's hair coat. It looked as though it had been there for weeks, maybe months, but he didn't know Sorensen well enough to mention it, nor, for that matter, did he give a damn. Besides, the train was arriving. Both boys turned a sort of half-left to face the incoming train. Almost at the same time, the door to the waiting room banged open, and the boys who had been keeping themselves warm began to come out to meet the train, most of them giving the impression of having at least 3 lighted cigarettes in each hand. Lane himself lit a cigarette as the train pulled in. Then, like so many people who, perhaps, ought to be issued only a very probational pass to meet trains, he tried to empty his face of all expression that might quite simply, perhaps even beautifully, reveal how he felt about the arriving person. Franny was among the first of the girls to get off the train, from a car at the far northern end of the platform. Lane spotted her immediately, and, despite whatever it was he was trying to do with his face, his arm that shot up into the air was the whole truth. Franny saw it, and him, and waved extravagantly back. She was wearing a sheared raccoon coat, and Lane, walking toward her quickly, but with a slow face, reasoned to himself, with surprised excitement, that he was the only one on the platform who really knew Franny's coat. He remembered that once, in a borrowed car, after kissing Franny for a half hour or so, he had kissed her coat lapel, as though it were a perfectly desirable, organic extension of the person herself. "Lane!" Franny greeted him pleasurably, and she was not one for emptying her face of expression. She threw her arms around him and kissed him. It was a station platform kiss, spontaneous enough to begin with, but rather inhibited in the follow-through, and with somewhat of a forehead-bumping aspect. "Did you get my letter?" she asked, and added, almost in the same breath, "You look almost frozen, you poor man. Why didn't you wait inside? Did you get my letter?" "Which letter?" Lane said, picking up her suitcase. It was navy blue with white leather binding, like half a dozen other suitcases that had just been carried off the train. "You didn't get it? I mailed it Wednesday. Oh, God! I even took it down to the post." "Oh, that one, yes. It's all the bags you brought. What's the book?" Franny looked down at her left hand. She had a small pea-green cloth-bound book in it. "This? Oh, just something," she said. She opened her handbag and stuffed the book into it and followed Lane down the long platform toward the taxi stand. She put her arm through his and did most of the talking, if not all of it. There was something, first, about a dress in her bag that had to be ironed, She said she'd bought a really darling little iron that looked like it went with a dollhouse, but had forgotten to bring it. She said she didn't think she'd known more than three girls on the train, Martha Farrar, Tippy Tibbet, and Eleanor somebody whom she'd met years ago in her boarding school days, at Exeter or someplace. Everybody else on the train, Franny said, looked very Smith, except for two absolutely Vassar types and one absolutely Bennington or Sarah Lawrence type. The Bennington-Sarah Lawrence type looked like she'd spent the whole train ride in the John, sculpting or painting or something, or as though she had a leotard on under her dress. Lane, walking rather too fast, said he was sorry he hadn't been able to get her into Croft House, oh, that was hopeless, of course, but that he'd got her into this very nice cozy place, small but clean and all that. She'd like it, he said, and Franny immediately had a vision of a white clabbered rooming house, three girls who didn't know each other in one room. Whoever got there first would get the lumpy day bed to herself, and the other two would share a double bed with an absolutely fantastic mattress. Lovely, she said with enthusiasm. Sometimes it was hell to conceal her impatience over the male of the species' general ineptness, and Lane's in particular. It reminded her of a rainy night in New York, just after theater, when Lane, with a suspicious excess of curbside charity, had let that really horrible man in the dinner jacket take that taxi away from him. She hadn't especially minded that. That is, God, it would be awful to have to be a man and have to get taxis in the rain. But she remembered Lane's really horrible, hostile look at her as he reported back to the curb. Now, feeling oddly guilty as she thought about that and other things, she gave Lane's arm a special little pressure of simulated affection. The two of them got into a cab. The navy blue bag with the white leather binding went up front with the driver. "We'll drop your bag and stuff where you're staying. Just chuck them in the door, and then we'll go get some lunch," Lane said. "I'm starved." He leaned forward and gave an address to the driver. "Oh, it's lovely to see you," Franny said as the cab moved off. "I missed you." The words were no sooner out than she realized that she didn't mean them at all. Again with guilt, she took Lane's hand and tightly, warmly laced fingers with him. About an hour later, the two were sitting at a comparatively isolated table in a restaurant called Sickler's downtown, a highly favored place among chiefly the intellectual friends of students at the college, the same students, more or less, who, had they been Yale or Harvard men, might rather too casually have steered their dates away from Morey's or Cronin's. Sickler's, it might be said, was the only restaurant in town where the steaks weren't that thick, thumb and index finger held an inch apart. Sickler's was snails. Sickler's was where a student and his date either both ordered salad or, usually, neither of them did because of the garlic seasoning. Franny and Lane were both having martinis. When the drinks had first been served to them, 10 or 15 minutes earlier, Lane had sampled his, then sat back and briefly looked around the room, with an almost palpable sense of well-being at finding himself, he must have been sure no one could dispute, in the right place with an impeachably right-looking girl, a girl who was not only extraordinarily pretty, but, so much the better, not too categorically cashmere sweater and flannel skirt. Franny had seen this momentary little exposure and had taken it in for what it was, neither more nor less. But by some old standing arrangement with her psyche, she elected to feel guilty for having seen it, caught it, and sentenced herself to listen to Lane's ensuing conversation with a special semblance of absorption. Lane was speaking now as someone does who has been monopolizing conversation for a good quarter of an hour or so and who believes he has just hit a stride where his voice can do absolutely no wrong. "I mean, to put it crudely," he was saying, "the thing you could say he lacks is testicularity. Know what I mean?" He was slouched rhetorically forward toward Franny, his receptive audience, a supporting forearm on either side of his martini. "Lacks what?" Franny said. She had had to clear her throat before speaking. It had been so long since she had said anything at all. Lane hesitated. Masculinity, he said.
I heard you the first time.
Anyway, that was the motif of the thing, so to speak. What I was trying to bring out in a fairly subtle way, Lane said, very closely following the trend of his own conversation. I mean, God, I honestly thought it was going to go over like a goddamn lead balloon. And when I got it back with this goddamn A on it in letters about 6 feet high, I swear I nearly keeled over. Franny again cleared her throat. Apparently her self-imposed sentence of unadulterated good listenership had been fully served.
Why? She asked.
Lane looked faintly interrupted. Why what?
Why'd you think it was going to go over like a lead balloon?
I just told you. I just got through saying this guy Brugman is a big Flaubert man, or at least I thought he was.
Oh, Franny said, and she smiled. She sipped her martini. This is marvelous, she said, looking at the glass. I'm so glad it's not about 20-1. I hate it when they're absolutely all gin.
Lane nodded. Anyway, I think I've got the goddamn paper in my room. If we get a chance over the weekend, I'll read it to you.
Marvelous. I'd love to hear it.
Lane nodded again. I mean, I didn't say anything too goddamn world-shaking or anything like that. He shifted his position in the chair. But, I don't know. I think the emphasis I put on why he was so neurotically attracted to the mot juste wasn't too bad. I mean, in the light of what we know today. Not just psychoanalysis and all that crap, but certainly to a certain extent. You know what I mean. I'm no Freudian man or anything like that, but certain things you can't just pass over as capital F Freudian and then let them go with that. I mean, to a certain extent, I think I was perfectly justified to point out that none of the really good boys, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, Shakespeare, or Christ's sake, were such goddamn word squeezers. They just wrote. Know what I mean? Lane looked at Franny somewhat expectantly. She seemed to him to have been listening with extra special intentness.
You going to eat your olive or what?
Lane gave his martini glass a brief glance and then looked back at Franny. No, he said coldly. You want it?
If you don't, Franny said.
She knew from Lane's expression that she had asked the wrong question. What was worse, she suddenly didn't want the olive at all and wondered why she had even asked for it. There was nothing to do, though, when Lane extended his martini glass to her but to accept the olive and consume it with apparent relish. She then took a cigarette from Lane's pack on the table, and he lit it for her and one for himself. After the interruption of the olive, a short silence came over the table. When Lane broke it, it was because he was not one to keep a punchline to himself for any length of time. "This guy Brugman thinks I ought to publish the goddamn paper somewhere," he said abruptly. "I don't know, though." Then, as though he had suddenly become exhausted, or rather depleted by the demands made on him by a world greedy for the fruit of his intellect, he began to massage the side of his face with the flat of his hand, removing, with unconscious crassness, a bit of sleep from one eye. "I mean, critical essays on Flaubert and those boys are a goddamn dime a dozen," he reflected, looking at trifle morose. "As a matter of fact, I don't think there have been any really incisive jobs done on him in the last..."
"You're talking like a section man, but exactly..."
"I beg your pardon," Lane said with measured quietness. "You're talking exactly like a section man. I'm sorry, but you are. You really are."
"I am? How does a section man talk, may I ask?"
Franny saw that he was irritated, and to what extent, but for the moment, with equal parts of self-disapproval and malice, she felt like speaking her mind.
"Well, I don't know what they are around here, but where I come from, a section man's a person that takes over a class when the professor isn't there or is busy having a nervous breakdown or is at the dentist or something. He's usually a graduate student or something. Anyway, if it's a course in Russian literature, say, he comes in in his little button-down collar shirt and striped tie and starts knocking Turgenev for about a half hour. Then when he's finished, when he's completely ruined Turgenev for you, he starts talking about Stendhal or somebody he wrote his thesis for his MA on. Where I go, the English department has about 10 little section men running around, ruining things for people, and they're all so brilliant they can hardly open their mouths. Pardon the contradiction. I mean, if you get into an argument with them, all they do is get this terribly benign expression on their... You got a goddamn bug today, you know that? What the hell's the matter with you anyway? Franny quickly tipped her cigarette ash, then brought the ashtray an inch closer to her side of the table. I'm sorry, I'm awful, she said. I've just felt so destructive all week. It's awful. I'm horrible. Your letter didn't sound so goddamn destructive. Franny nodded solemnly. She was looking at a little warm blotch of sunshine, about the size of a poker chip on the tablecloth. I had to strain to write it, she said. Lane started to say something to that, but the waiter was suddenly there to take away the empty martini glasses. You want another one? Lane asked Franny. He didn't get an answer. Franny was staring at the little blotch of sunshine with a special intensity, as if she were considering lying down in it. Franny, Lane said patiently for the waiter's benefit, would you like another martini or what? She looked up. I'm sorry. She looked at the removed empty glasses in the waiter's hand. No. Yes. I don't know. Lane gave a laugh, looking at the waiter. Which is it? He said. Yes, please. And she looked more alert. The waiter left. Lane watched him leave the room, then looked back at Franny. She was shaping her cigarette ash on the side of the fresh ashtray the waiter had brought, her mouth not quite closed. Lane watched her for a moment with mounting irritation. Quite probably, he resented and feared any signs of detachment in a girl he was seriously dating. In any case, he surely was concerned over the possibility that this bug Franny had might bitch up the whole weekend. He suddenly leaned forward, putting his arms on the table, as though to get this thing ironed out, by God. But Franny spoke up before he did. I'm lousy today, she said. I'm just way off today. She found herself looking at Lane as if he were a stranger or a poster advertising a brand of linoleum across the aisle of a subway car. Again, she felt the trickle of disloyalty and guilt, which seemed to be the order of the day, and reacted to it by reaching over to cover Lane's hand with her own. She withdrew her hand almost immediately and used it to pick her cigarette out of the ashtray. I'll snap out of this in a minute, she said. I absolutely promise. She smiled at Lane, in a sense, genuinely. And at that moment, a smile in return might at least have mitigated, to some small extent, certain events that were to follow. But Lane was busy affecting a brand of detachment of his own and chose not to smile back. Franny dragged on her cigarette. If it weren't so late and everything, she said, and if I hadn't decided like a fool to go out for honors, I think I'd drop English. I don't know. She tipped her ashes. I'm just so sick of pedants and conceited little terror downers, I could scream. She looked at Lane. I'm sorry, I'll stop. I'll give you my word. It's just that if I'd had any guts at all, I wouldn't have gone back to college at all this year. I don't know. I mean, it's all the most incredible farce. Brilliant. That's really brilliant. Franny took the sarcasm as her due. I'm sorry, she said. Stop saying you're sorry. Do you mind? I don't suppose it's occurred to you that you're making one hell of a sweeping generalization. If all English department people were such great little terror downers, it would be an altogether different... Franny interrupted him, but almost inaudibly. She was looking over his charcoal flannel shoulder at some abstraction across the dining room. What? Lane asked. I said, I know, you're right. I'm just off, that's all. Don't pay any attention to me. But Lane couldn't let the controversy drop until it had been resolved in his favor. I mean, hell, he said, there are incompetent people in all walks of life. I mean, that's basic. Let's drop the goddamn section men for a minute. He looked at Franny. You listening to me or what? Yes. You've got two of the best men in the country in your goddamn English department. Manlius, Esposito. God, I wish we had them here. At least they're poets, for Christ's sake. They're not, Franny said. That's partly what's so awful. I mean, they're not real poets. They're just people that write poems that get published and anthologized all over the place, but they're not poets. She stopped, self-consciously, and put out her cigarette. For several minutes now, she had seemed to be losing color in her face. Suddenly, even her lipstick seemed a shade or two lighter, as though she had just blotted it with a leaf of Kleenex. Let's not talk about it, she said, almost listlessly, squashing her cigarette stub in the ashtray. I'm way off. I'll just ruin the whole weekend. Maybe there's a trap door under my chair, and I'll just disappear. The waiter came forward very briefly and left a second martini in front of each of them. Lane put his fingers, which were slender and long and usually not far out of sight, around the stem of his glass. You're not ruining anything, he said quietly. I'm just interested in finding out what the hell goes. I mean, do you have to be a goddamn bohemian type or dead, for Christ's sake, to be a real poet? What do you want? Some jerk with wavy hair? No, can't we let it go, please? I'm feeling absolutely lousy, and I'm getting a terrible... Well, I'd be very happy to drop the whole subject. I'd be delighted. Just tell me first what a real poet is, if you don't mind. I'd appreciate it. I really would. There was a faint glisten of perspiration high on Franny's forehead. It might only have meant that the room was too warm or that her stomach was upset or that the martinis were too potent. In any case, Lane didn't seem to notice it. I don't know what a real poet is. I wish you'd stop it, Lane. I'm serious. I'm feeling very peculiar and funny, and I can't... All right, all right, all right. Okay, relax, Lane said. I was only trying. I know this much is all, Franny said. If you're a poet, you do something beautiful. I mean, you're supposed to leave something beautiful after you get off the page and everything. The ones you're talking about don't leave a single solitary thing beautiful. All that maybe the slightly better ones do is sort of get inside your head and leave something there, but just because they do, just because they know how to leave something... It doesn't have to be a poem, for heaven's sake. It may just be some kind of terribly fascinating syntaxy droppings, excuse the expression, like Manlius and Esposito and all those poor men. Lane took time to light a cigarette for himself before he said anything. Then, I thought you liked Manlius. As a matter of fact, about a month ago, if I remember correctly, you said he was darling and that you... I do like him. I'm sick of just liking people. I wish to God I could meet somebody I could respect. Would you excuse me for just a minute? Franny was suddenly on her feet with her handbag in her hand. She was very pale. Lane got up, pushing back his chair, his mouth somewhat open. What's the matter? He asked. You feel all right? Anything wrong or what? I'll be back in just a second. She left the room without asking directions, as though she knew from former lunches at Sickler's just where to go. Lane, alone at the table, sat smoking and taking conservative drinks from his martini to make it last till Franny got back. It was very clear that the sense of well-being he had felt a half hour earlier at being in the right place with the right or right-looking girl was now totally gone. He looked over at the sheared raccoon coat, which lay somewhat askew over the back of Franny's vacant chair. The same coat that had excited him at the station by virtue of his singular familiarity with it. And he examined it now with all but unqualified disaffection. The wrinkles in the silk lining seemed, for some reason, to annoy him. He stopped looking at it and began to stare at the stem of his martini glass, looking worried and vaguely unfairly conspired against. One thing was sure. The weekend was certainly getting off to a goddamn peculiar start. At that moment, though, he chanced to look up from the table and see someone he knew across the room, a classmate with a date. Lane sat up a bit in his chair and adjusted his expression from that of an all-round apprehension and discontent to that of a man whose date has merely gone to the John, leaving him, as dates do, with nothing to do in the meantime but smoke and look bored, preferably attractively bored. The ladies' room at Sickler's was almost as large as the dining room proper, and in a special sense appeared to be hardly less commodious. It was unattended and apparently unoccupied when Franny came in. She stood for a moment, rather as though it were a rendezvous point of some kind, in the middle of the tiled floor. Her brow was beaded with perspiration now, her mouth was slackly open, and she was still paler than she had been in the dining room. Abruptly then, and very quickly, she went into the farthest and most anonymous looking of the 7 or 8 enclosures, which, by luck, didn't require a coin for entrance, closed the door behind her, and, with some little difficulty, manipulated the bolt to a locked position. Without any apparent regard to the suchness of her environment, she sat down. She brought her knees together very firmly, as if to make herself a smaller, more compact unit. Then she placed her hands vertically over her eyes and pressed the heels hard, as though to paralyze the optic nerve and drown all images into a void-like black. Her extended fingers, though trembling, or because they were trembling, looked oddly graceful and pretty. She held that tense, almost fetal position for a suspensory moment and then broke down. She cried for fully 5 minutes. She cried without trying to suppress any of the noisier manifestations of grief and confusion, with all the convulsive throat sounds that a hysterical child makes when the breath is trying to get up through a partly closed epiglottis. And yet, when finally she stopped, she merely stopped, without the painful knife-like intakes of breath that usually follow a violent outburst. When she stopped, it was as though some momentous change of polarity had taken place inside her mind, one that had an immediate pacifying effect on her body. Her face, tear-streaked, but quite expressionless, almost vacuous, she picked up her handbag from the floor, opened it, and took out the small, pea-green, cloth-bound book. She put it on her lap, on her knees, rather, and looked down at it, gazed down at it, as if that were the best of all places for a small, pea-green, cloth-bound book to be. After a moment, she picked up the book, raised it chest-high, and pressed it to her, firmly and quite briefly. Then she put it back into the handbag, stood up, and came out of the enclosure. She washed her face with cold water, dried it with a towel from an overhead rack, applied fresh lipstick, combed her hair, and left the room. She looked quite stunning as she walked across the dining room to the table, not at all unlike a girl on the qui vive appropriate to a big college weekend. As she came briskly, smiling, to her chair, Lane slowly got up, a napkin in his left hand. "God, I'm sorry," Franny said. "Did you think I died?" "I didn't think you died," Lane said. He drew her chair for her. "I didn't know what the hell happened." He went around to his own chair. "We don't have too goddamn much time, you know," he sat down. "You all right? Your eyes are a little bloodshot." He looked at her more closely. "You okay, or what?" Franny lit a cigarette. "I'm marvelous now. I just never felt so fantastically rocky in my entire life. Did you order?" "I waited for you," Lane said, still looking at her closely. "What was the matter, anyway? Your stomach?" "No, yes, and no, I don't know," Franny said. She looked down at the menu on her plate and consulted it without picking it up. All I want's a chicken sandwich and maybe a glass of milk. You order what you want and all, though. I mean, take snails and octopuses and things. Octopi. I'm really not at all hungry. Lane looked at her, then exhaled a thin, overly expressive stream of smoke down at his plate. This is going to be a real doll of a weekend, he said. A chicken sandwich, for God's sake. Franny was annoyed. I'm not hungry, Lane. I'm sorry. My gosh, now please. You order what you want, why don't you? And I'll eat while you're eating, but I can't just work up an appetite because you want me to. All right, Lane craned his neck and caught the waiter's attention. A moment later, he ordered the chicken sandwich and the glass of milk for Franny, and snails, frog's legs, and a salad for himself. He looked at his wristwatch when the waiter had gone and said, we're supposed to be up at Tinbridge at 1:15, 1:30, incidentally, no later. I told Wally we'd probably stop off for a drink, and then maybe we'd all go out to the stadium together in his car. You mind? You like Wally. I don't even know who he is. You've met him about 20 times, for God's sake. Wally Campbell. Jesus. If you've met him once, you've met him... Oh, I remember. Listen, don't hate me because I can't remember some person immediately, especially when they look like everybody else and talk and dress and act like everybody else. Franny made her voice stop. It sounded to her cavilling and bitchy, and she felt a wave of self-hatred that quite literally made her forehead begin to perspire again. But her voice picked up again in spite of herself. I don't mean there's anything horrible about him or anything like that. It's just that for 4 solid years I've kept seeing Wally Campbells wherever I go. I know when they're going to be charming. I know when they're going to start telling you some really nasty gossip about some girl that lives in your dorm. I know when they're going to ask me what I did over the summer. I know when they're going to pull up a chair and straddle it backward and start bragging in a terribly, terribly quiet voice or name-dropping or in a terribly quiet, casual voice. There's an unwritten law that people in a certain social or financial bracket can name-drop as much as they like, just as long as they say something terribly disparaging about the person as soon as they've dropped his name. That he's a bastard or a nymphomaniac or takes dope all the time or something horrible. She broke off again. She was quiet for a moment, turning the ashtray in her fingers and being careful not to look up and see Lane's expression. I'm sorry, she said. It isn't just Wally Campbell. I'm just picking on him because you mentioned him. And because he just looks like somebody that spent the summer in Italy or someplace. He was in France last summer, for your information, Lane stated. I know what you mean, he added quickly, but you're being goddamn un... All right, Franny said wearily. France. She took a cigarette out of the pack on the table. It isn't just Wally. It could be a girl, for goodness sake. I mean, if he were a girl, somebody in my dorm, for example... He'd have been painting scenery in some stock company all summer, or bicycled through Wales, or taken an apartment in New York and worked for a magazine or an advertising company. It's everybody, I mean. Everything everybody does is so, I don't know, not wrong, or even mean, or even stupid necessarily, but just so tiny and meaningless and sad-making. And the worst part is, if you go bohemian or something crazy like that, you're conforming just as much as everybody else, only in a different way. She stopped. She shook her head briefly, her face quite white, and for just a fractional moment, she felt her forehead with her hand. Less, it seemed, to find out whether she was perspiring than to check to see, as if she were her own parent, whether she had a fever. I feel so funny, she said. I think I'm going crazy. Maybe I'm already crazy. Lane was looking at her with genuine concern, more concern than curiosity. You're pale as hell. You're really pale. You know that? He asked.
Franny shook her head.
I'm fine. I'll be fine in a minute.
She looked up as the waiter came forward with their orders.
Oh, your snails look beautiful.
She had just brought her cigarette to her lips, but it had gone out.
What'd you do with the matches? She asked.
Lane gave her a light when the waiter had gone. You smoke too much, he said. He picked up the small fork beside his plate of snails, but looked at Franny again before he used it. I'm worried about you. I'm serious.
What the hell's happened to you in the last couple of weeks?
Franny looked at him, then simultaneously shrugged and shook her head.
Nothing, absolutely nothing, she said. Eat. Eat them snails. They're terrible if they're cold.
You eat.
Franny nodded and looked down at her chicken sandwich. She felt a faint wave of nausea and looked up immediately and dragged on her cigarette.
How's the play? Lane asked, attending to his snails.
I don't know. I'm not in it. I quit.
You quit? Lane looked up. I thought you were so mad about the part. What happened? They give it to somebody else?
No, they did not. It was all mine. That's nasty. Oh, that's nasty.
Well, what happened? You didn't quit the whole department, did you?
Franny nodded and took a sip of her milk.
Lane waited till he had chewed and swallowed and then said, Why, for God's sake? I thought the goddamn theater was your passion.
It's about the only thing I've ever heard you... I just quit, that's all, Franny said. It started embarrassing me. I began to feel like such a nasty little egomaniac. And she reflected, I don't know. It seemed like such poor taste, sort of, to want to act in the first place. I mean, all the ego. And I used to hate myself so when I was in a play to be backstage after the play was over. All those egos running around feeling terribly charitable and warm, kissing everybody and wearing their makeup all over the place, and then trying to be horribly natural and friendly when your friends came backstage to see you. I just hated myself. And the worst part was I was usually sort of ashamed to be in the plays, especially in Summerstock. She looked at Lane. And I had good parts, and so don't look at me that way. It wasn't that. It was just that I would have been ashamed if, say, anybody I respected, my brothers, for example, came and heard me deliver some of the lines I had to say. I used to write certain people and tell them not to come. She reflected again. Except Pete Jean in Playboy last summer. I mean, that could have been really nice. Only the goon that played the Playboy spoiled any fun it might have been. He was so lyrical. God, was he lyrical.
Lane had finished his snails. He sat looking deliberately expressionless. He got terrific reviews, he said. You sent me the reviews, if you recall.
Franny sighed. All right, okay, Lane.
No, I mean, you've been talking for half an hour, so you're the only person in the world that's got any goddamn sense, any critical ability. I mean, if some of the best critics thought this man was terrific in the play, maybe he was, maybe you're wrong. That ever occur to you? You know, you haven't exactly reached the ripe old...
Well, he was terrific for somebody that just has talent. If you're going to play the Playboy right, you have to be a genius. You do, that's all. I can't help it, Franny said.
She arched her back a trifle, and, with her mouth a trifle open, she put her hand on top of her head.
I feel so woozy and funny. I don't know what's the matter with me.
You think you're a genius?
Franny took her hand down from her head. Oh, Lane, please, don't do that to me.
I'm not doing any.
All I know is I'm losing my mind, Franny said. I'm just sick of ego, 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 my own and everybody else's. I'm sick of everybody that wants to get somewhere to do something distinguished and all that. Be somebody interesting. It's disgusting. It is, it is. I don't care what anybody says.
Lane raised his eyebrows at that and sat back, the better to make his point. You sure you're just not afraid of competing? He asked with studied quietness. I don't know too much about it, but I'd lay odds a good psychoanalyst, I mean a really competent one, would probably take that statement
I'm not afraid to compete. It's just the opposite. Don't you see that? I'm afraid I will compete. That's what scares me. That's why I quit the theater department. Just because I'm so horribly conditioned to accept everybody else's values, and just because I like applause and people to rave about me, doesn't make it right. I'm ashamed of it. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of not having the courage to be an absolute nobody. I'm sick of myself and everybody else that wants to make some kind of splash. She paused and suddenly picked up her glass of milk and brought it to her lips. I knew it, she said, setting it down. That's something new. My teeth go funny on me. They're chattering. I nearly bit through a glass the day before yesterday. Maybe I'm stark, raving mad and don't know it. The waiter had come forward to serve Lane's frog's legs and salad, and Franny looked up at him. He, in turn, looked down at her untouched chicken sandwich. He asked if the young lady would perhaps like to change her order. Franny thanked him and said, No, I'm just very slow, she said. The waiter, who was not a young man, seemed to look for an instant at her pallor and damp brow and then bowed and left. You want to use this a second? Lane said abruptly. He was holding out a folded white handkerchief. His voice sounded sympathetic, kind, in spite of some perverse attempt to make it sound matter-of-fact. Why do I need it? You're sweating. Not sweating, but I mean your forehead's perspiring quite a bit. It is? How horrible. I'm sorry. Franny brought her handbag up to the table level, opened it, and began to rummage through it. I have some Kleenex somewhere. Use my handkerchief, for God's sake. What the hell's the difference? No, I love that handkerchief, and I'm not going to get it all perspiry, Franny said. Her handbag was a crowded one. To see better, she began to unload a few things and place them on the tablecloth, just to the left of her untasted sandwich. Here it is, she said. She used a compact mirror and quickly, lightly blotted her brow with a leaf of Kleenex. God, I look like a ghost. How can you stand me? What's the book? Lane asked. Franny literally jumped. She looked down at the disorderly little pile of handbag freight on the table. What book? She said. This, you mean? She picked up the little cloth-bound book and put it back into her handbag. Just something I brought to look at on the train. Well, let's have a look. What is it? Franny didn't seem to hear him. She opened her compact again and took another quick glance into the mirror. God, she said. And then she cleared everything, compact, billfold, laundry bill, toothbrush, a tin of aspirins, and a gold-plated swizzle stick back into her handbag. I don't know why I carry that crazy gold swizzle stick around, she said. A very corny boy gave it to me when I was a sophomore for my birthday. He thought it was such a beautiful and inspired gift, and he kept watching my face while I opened the package. I keep trying to throw it away, but I simply can't do it. I'll go to my grave with it, she reflected. He kept grinning at me and telling me I'd always have good luck if I kept it with me at all times. Lane had started in on his frog legs. Well, what was the book, anyway? Or is it a goddamn secret or something? He asked. The little book in my bag, Franny said. She watched him disjoint a pair of frog legs. Then she took a cigarette from the pack on the table and lit herself. Oh, I don't know, she said. It's something called the Way of a Pilgrim. She watched Lane eat for a moment. I got it out of the library. This man that teaches this religion survey thing I'm taking this term mentioned it. She dragged on her cigarette. I've had it out for weeks. I keep forgetting to return it. Who wrote it? I don't know, Franny said casually. Some Russian peasant, apparently. She went on watching Lane eat his frog legs. He never gives his name. You never know his name the whole time he's telling the story. He just tells you he's a peasant and that he's 33 years old and that he's got a withered arm and that his wife is dead. It's all in the 1800s. Lane had just shifted his attention from the frog legs to the salad. Any good? Yes. What's it about? I don't know. It's peculiar. I mean, it's primarily a religious book. In a way, I suppose you could say it's terribly fanatical, but in a way it isn't. I mean, it starts out with this peasant, the pilgrim, wanting to find out what it means in the Bible when it says you should pray incessantly. You know, without stopping. In Thessalonians or someplace, so he starts out walking all over Russia, looking for somebody who can tell him how to pray incessantly. And what you should say if you do. Franny seemed intensely interested in the way Lane was dismembering his frog legs. Her eyes remained fixed on his plate as she spoke. All he carries with him is this knapsack filled with bread and salt. Then he meets this person called a Steritz, some sort of terribly advanced religious person, and the Steritz tells him about a book called the Philokalia, which apparently was written by a group of terribly advanced monks who sort of advocated this really incredible method of praying.
Hold still, Lane said to a pair of frog's legs.
Anyway, so the pilgrim learns how to pray the way these very mystical persons say you should. I mean, he keeps at it till he's perfected it and everything. And then he goes on walking all over Russia, meeting all kinds of absolutely marvelous people and telling them how to pray by this incredible method. I mean, that's really the whole book.
I hate to mention it, but I'm going to reek of garlic, Lane said.
He meets this one married couple on one of his journeys that I love more than anybody I've ever read about in my entire life, Franny said. He's walking down a road somewhere in the country with his knapsack on his back when these two tiny little children run after him shouting, "Dear little beggar, dear little beggar, you must come home to Mummy. She likes beggars." So he goes home with the children, and this really lovely person, the children's mother, comes out of the house all in a bustle and insists on helping him take off his dirty old boots and giving him a cup of tea. Then the father comes home, and apparently he loves beggars and pilgrims too, and they all sit down to dinner. And while they're at dinner, the pilgrim wants to know who all the ladies are that are sitting around the table, and the husband tells him that they are all servants, but that they always sit down to eat with him and his wife because they're sisters in Christ.
Franny suddenly sat up, a trifle straighter in her seat, self-consciously.
I mean, I loved the pilgrim wanting to know who all the ladies were.
She watched Lane butter a piece of bread.
Anyway, after that, the pilgrim stays overnight, and he and the husband sit up till late talking about this method of praying without ceasing. And the pilgrim tells him how to do it. And then he leaves in the morning and starts out on some more adventures. He meets all kinds of people. I mean, that's the whole book, really, and he tells all of them how to pray by this special way.
Lane nodded. He cut into his salad with his fork. I hope to God we get time over the weekend so you can take a quick look at this goddamn paper I told you about, he said. I don't know. I may not do a damn thing with it. I mean, try to publish it or what have you. But I'd like you to sort of glance through it while you're here.
Well, I'd love to, Franny said. And she watched him butter another piece of bread. You might like this book, she said suddenly. It's so simple, I mean.
Sounds interesting. You don't want your butter, do you?
No, take it. Can't lend it to you because it's way overdue already, but you could probably get it at the library here. I'm positive you could.
You haven't touched your goddamn sandwich, Lane said suddenly. You know that?
Franny looked down at her plate as if it had just been placed before her. I will in a minute, she said.
She sat still for a moment, holding her cigarette, but without dragging on it in her left hand and with her right hand fixed tensely around the base of the glass of milk.
Do you want to hear what the special method of praying was that the Steritz told him about, she asked. It's really sort of interesting in a way.
Lane cut into his last pair of frog slates. He nodded. Sure, he said, sure.
Well, as I said, the pilgrim, this simple peasant, started the whole pilgrimage to find out what it means in the Bible when it says you're supposed to pray without ceasing. And then he meets this Steritz, this very advanced religious person I mentioned, the one who'd been studying the Philokalia for years and years and years.
Franny stopped suddenly to reflect, to organize.
Well, the Steritz tells him about the Jesus prayer first of all. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me.
I mean, that's what it is. And he explains to him that those are the best words to use when you pray, especially the word mercy, because it's such a really enormous word and can mean so many things.
I mean, it doesn't just have to mean mercy.
Franny paused to reflect again.
She was no longer looking at Lane's plate, but over his shoulder. Anyway, she went on, the Starets tells the pilgrim that if you keep saying that prayer over and over again, you only have to just do it with your lips at first. Then eventually, what happens? The prayer becomes self-active. Something happens after a while. I don't know what, but something happens, and the words get synchronized with the person's heartbeats, and then you're actually praying without ceasing, which has a really tremendous mystical effect on your whole outlook. I mean, that's the whole point of it, more or less. I mean, you do it to purify your whole outlook and get an absolutely new conception of what everything's about. Lane had finished eating. Now, as Franny paused again, he sat back and lit a cigarette and watched her face. She was still looking abstractedly ahead of her, past his shoulder, and seemed scarcely aware of his presence. But the thing is, the marvelous thing is, when you first start doing it, you don't even have to have faith in what you're doing. I mean, even if you're terribly embarrassed about the whole thing, it's perfectly all right. I mean, you're not insulting anybody or anything. In other words, nobody asks you to believe a single thing when you first start out. You don't even have to think about what you're saying. All you have to have in the beginning is quantity. Then later on, it becomes quality by itself, on its own power or something. He says that any name of God, any name at all, has this peculiar self-active power of its own, and it starts working after you've sort of started it up. Lane sat rather slouched in his chair, smoking. His eyes narrowed attentively at Franny's face. Her face was still pale, but it had been paler at other moments since the two had been in Sickler's. As a matter of fact, that makes absolute sense, Franny said, because in the Nimbutsu sects of Buddhism, people keep saying Namu Amida Butsu over and over again, which means praises to the Buddha, or something like that. And the same thing happens. The exact same... Easy, take it easy, Lane interrupted. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll come back next week to listen to the ending of the story. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.